And good morning. Welcome to Focus 580 for a Friday morning. This is Les Schulte filling in for David Inge this morning. And one of our favorite and regular guests is with us this morning, David Sidow. David is a clinical professor of finance here at the College of Business at the University of Illinois. Good morning, David.
Well, good morning, Les. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Also, I'm very pleased that my colleague and good friend John Masetich is with us this morning. John is a professional money manager with clients literally all over the world. He's a certified financial planner and spends about, 8 weeks each year at the University of Illinois teaching classes in financial planning and how to finance. John and I will be discussing in just a few minutes foreign stocks and the direction of interest rates. But before doing so, however, I do want to spend just a brief amount of time discussing certain IRA issues, which were raised by a retired faculty member at the University of Illinois, as well as giving you a monthly update on the couch potato portfolio. Well, just last week, a colleague mentioned that he was reaching that magic age, Les, of 70 and a half, and he had several different traditional IRAs at several brokerage firms and mutual fund companies. Since he was about to reach 70 and a half, he would be required to take a minimum distribution. And the question arose, do I have to take that minimum distribution from each account, or rather could I just access one account and essentially take enough so it covers the minimum distribution from all of these accounts? And the answer to that question is, yes. Simply notify the brokerage firms where you choose not to take IRA funds that you really have satisfied your minimum distribution requirement by taking additional funds from another IRA. So you don't have to necessarily, when you reach 70 and a half, if you have more than one account, hemorrhage that particular account, especially if you're excited with the investments in that account. The question also arises, how much? I'm 70 and a half. I guess I'm not a youngster anymore. How much must I take to satisfy minimum distribution requirements? Eventually, one looks back at the previous 12/31 balance. So if I was taking money this month, for example, in September of 07, I would go back and look at my December 31 of 06 balances in my IRAs, and then I would consult with the IRS published tables, which are called minimum distribution tables. These tables are very easy to find. Simply Google, for example, minimum distribution table or minimum IRA distribution table, and popping up will be 15 or 20 sites which will give you those precise annuity tables. In a nutshell, when you reach about 70 and a half, figure about 1/27th of the balance would be required to be taken out. Not a lot, because when we think about it, that's what, about 4%? So if you were earning 5, 6, 7, or 8% in the early years of minimum distributions, the account is actually still growing. And in fact, I want you to remember that if you are talking about a Roth IRA as opposed to traditional IRAs, you never have to take the money out. There is no requirement at 70 and a half. You can just let that money ride. And eventually, if you don't take it out, it passes to the named beneficiary. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're having a problem figuring out who that named beneficiary should be, please call me off the air. I'll be delighted to give you my full name, address, etc. It wouldn't be any problem whatsoever. All right. Let's take a quick look, if you will, at our couch potato portfolio, consisting of 8 index funds in various percentages. Recall that these indexes or asset class funds include such as the S&P 500, large value, small value, the mid-caps, REITs, real estate investment trusts, and of course, 2 or 3 international indexes as well. Now, the asset allocation in terms of these indexes is available on the WILL website. Simply click on Focus 580, click on the links, click on Couch Potato, or Jack Brighton told me today that you just go to this show today and it's right there. And we have it updated through last night's close. Well, at least through yesterday's close, the portfolio is ahead 7.92% for the year, inclusive of dividends. Not bad, considering all of the volatility that we've had. I presume that there's a number of people who are not up about 8% for the year. But in all fairness, I have always mentioned that our benchmark, we're benchmarking toward the S&P 500. We feel that we have a more diversified portfolio than the S&P 500. But how has the S&P 500 done through yesterday's close, inclusive of dividends? That's ahead 8.46%. So the couch potato portfolio is trailing the S&P 500 at the moment. Call it a half a percent, call it 50 basis points. So I guess we'll have to just stay tuned because it's a kind of a close battle here on the engineering track. We'll just have to see how that ends up. All right, let's bring in John Masetich into the discussion. Good morning, John.
Good morning, David. Thank you.
And John, let's start with foreign stocks. I know that you have a lot of information, some very strong opinions about foreign stocks. And I know John isn't going to tell you this, but about 18 months ago was the last time John was on this program. And going back to my notes, guess who was a solid, substantial, strong advocate of literally weighting your portfolio into foreign stocks? I sort of hate to admit it, but the guy to my left here, the money manager, he was right. Foreign stocks have done extremely well. So he won't tell you that, but it was a strong recommendation some 18 months ago. John, go ahead.
Well, thank you, David. And actually, I was going to tell the listeners that very item.
All right.
And actually, you know, David, going back, I think the first time I was here was maybe 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You and I pretty much had the same story that we weren't telling our listeners to put all of their money in foreign stocks and avoid the American stock market entirely. But we were saying, I think, you know, put maybe 30-40% in the foreign markets. That story that we first posed 3-4 years ago has gotten even better. And let me put some numbers on this. Our listeners can easily track what's happening in the foreign markets by just taking a look at one mutual fund in the paper, the Vanguard Total International Index Fund. This is a fund that's invested in a broad array of European and Asian stocks, the so-called developed world, the rich countries, you know, Europe, Japan, and so forth. And there's a bit of emerging market stocks in this fund as well. The year-to-date performance of this fund is 13.1. Pretty good. And as you mentioned, the Vanguard Index 500 fund, by contrast, which is strictly the American market, is about 8.5. So 13.1 versus 8.5. Let me tell you about the 5- and 10-year numbers. They're even better. Over the last 5 years, the average annual return in the Vanguard Total International Market Fund is 24% per year.
Wow.
24%
That's
per year.
That's a big number, John.
Versus 14.4 in the American market, which is also quite good. So 24 versus 14.4. The 10-year number is even more impressive, 16% per year versus 6.7 in the American market. So that leads to the question, why are the foreign markets doing better than our market? Okay. Well, I can identify at least two reasons. One is that the emerging markets, especially those markets in China and India, are doing quite well. This is not a new story. Everybody's read about the rise of China and India in the paper. Both of them have gone strongly capitalistic. GDP growth rates are very high in these countries, 7 to 11%. When the GDP rises at such a high rate, guess what? Corporate earnings rise at a very high rate. And when corporate earnings rise, stock prices rise. Corporate earnings are the ultimate determinant of stock prices. Now, all that said, I will say, though, that China stocks and Indian stocks are very risky. And if you're going to play this market, I recommend a very small percentage of your foreign stock allocation in China and India. In fact, I recommend that China stocks and India stocks ought to be within the confines of one or two international funds, well-diversified funds. The second reason why I think that the foreign stocks have done so much better than our market comes down to Europe. And this is a very positive story. In Europe, they have largely restructured their economy. A lot of industries that were heretofore nationalized are now privatized. And the top marginal tax brackets for citizens have gone way, way down over the last five or six years. In other words, they are moving more to the American model. Our top tax bracket is 35%. In Sweden, in Scandinavia in general, about 10 years ago, the top bracket, believe it or not, was 80 to 90%. You know, versus our 35%. Now the top bracket in Scandinavia is down to about 45 or 50%. Scandinavia is pretty much like the rest of Europe. So that's one reason. Marginal tax rates have gone down. Government spending has gone down. And corporate tax rates have gone way, way down. Germany is another case. Germany is the largest economy in Europe. And they've also, the new chancellor, Angela Merkel, the first female chancellor of Germany, has implemented a lot of pro-market reforms. Tax rates have gone down. Government intervention has gone down. So Germany is now recovering very nicely. Ireland is another real success story.
That's an amazing story.
Ireland. 30 years ago, Ireland was a poor country. Today, get this, they have the highest per capita income in all of Europe. And I think part of the reason is that they have the lowest corporate tax rate. The lowest corporate tax rate. They have a lower corporate tax rate than we do. The result is Apple is over there now, Hewlett-Packard, all of these wonderful high-tech companies. And so Ireland, highest per capita income in Europe.
So that's easy to understand. Money moves where it's treated reasonably well, and
exactly.
It's treated well in Ireland.
And, you know, if you were to have read stories in the Wall Street Journal just 2 or 3 years ago about Europe, you'd have come across a term the journal loves to use, eurosclerosis. Okay. Now, medically speaking, I'm not sure what sclerosis means, but it doesn't sound good. It
doesn't sound good, John.
But, you know, you don't hear this term much anymore when you read journal articles or New York Times articles, eurosclerosis. Now we see growth rates in Germany, GDP growth rates, that rival our growth rate. And in many cases, as in the case of Ireland and even Scandinavia, they have a higher growth rate than we do. So this leads to the question, how can we profit from this? Well, the obvious answer is to have some international or foreign stocks. And what I recommend is just having two, maybe three well-diversified international funds that are based in the United States. We have good regulation in this country, NASD and SEC regulation. You mentioned before that your split, I think, in your couch potato portfolio is about 70-30.
Right. I have 30%. I have 25% in total international and 5% emerging markets.
Okay.
So does that meet your test?
Yeah. That 70-30 split, American versus foreign, is a traditional split. But I've changed my mind a little bit. I've now moved to about 50-50.
Oh, you're aggressive, John.
Right. For myself and also for my clients. I take my cue from Warren Buffett, arguably the greatest investor of all time.
Okay.
Right now, I believe when you look at a stock portfolio, he's got about as much in foreign stocks as he does in the American stock market. And he thinks that the dollar will continue to go down. If the dollar goes down, that means the euro is going up. That means the yen is going up. So all of the factors being equal, if the foreign currencies go up and our currency is going down, you will make money, all of the factors being equal.
Okay, and for example, today I think the euro hit what? Or the dollar hit an all-time low against the euro?
All-time
today.
Low at almost $1.42.
All right, and Canada and the U.S. are now at parity.
That's right.
In the olden days, when I used to go fishing in Ontario, it was about 60 cents on the dollar, and
that's
now
right.
We're a dollar for a dollar.
So this is right. Kind of a good news, bad news story. The bad news is that if you go to Europe as a tourist, as we did recently.
As we did.
Things are 5 to 10% more expensive than they were about a year ago. But the good news is that you can make up for that added expense as a tourist in Europe by being in, you know, one or two well-diversified international funds. Look at Vanguard, and there's another fund that I like called Harbor International. I've had it forever, no load, very similar to Vanguard. So I'm bullish. I'm more bullish than ever on the foreign markets. But, of course, there's risk. We have to be cautious. You know, there's no guarantee that these high rates of return are going to continue. For example, the Swedish stock market has tripled in 5 years. I do not think the Swedish market is going to triple in the next 5 years. And I really don't think that the China market is going to double in the next 2 or 3 years as it has, you know, the last 2 or 3 years. But everything is relative. I still think, for various reasons, that Europe and Asia are going to do a bit better than the American market.
Okay. Well, that gives us a lot of food for thought. I don't know if our callers want to react to that or some other issues. We have interest rate issues we can talk about,
sure,
et cetera.
Let's find out. If you have a question for either John or David, I think we have the guys here that can answer your personal finance questions or international finance questions. Call us right now at 333-9455. We're outside the 217 area code, 800-222-9455, and we have a caller on the line from Belgium. Good morning. You're on the air with David Sinow.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Sinow, I think I spoke with you about, this last summer when Mr. Inge had you on, and I pointed out at a problem that was emerging at that time, and, well, now it's become much more serious, and with what you've just discussed, you can see that we're really having some serious problems here. Number one, what I brought up to you is when the some banks in Spain and I think it was Belgium were failing because of some market situations going on with the home loans here in the United States. And their countries bailed them out by giving them money, which is essentially printing money. Well, now that same problem has come to the United States with Countryside, also to England with Northern Rock. And the United States, we lowered the interest rates. England is guaranteeing notes, okay? Everybody is essentially printing money here to get out of a financial problem that the people, mainly in Europe, but here in the United States, we've wanted to get more interest on our investments, so we went to encouraging people to be in home loans that they couldn't be in. And now the price has got to be paid to the piper because these people can't meet the loans in the first place. So we got to really worry about what's going on in Europe, because I'm not sure that what your guest there said is completely true in that he mentioned Ireland. Well, Ireland has become so rich is because they've gotten a lot of subsidies to bring some of these people there. One notable company is Hyster Corporation. They were given a lot of money to take U.S. jobs to Ireland to produce the trucks that they brought back to the United States. And it made a lot of money for them to do it that way. So it's not just because Ireland has started investing more money and taking not corporate taxes. It's because they've given incentives for these people to invest over there. So thank you very much.
All right. Let's get some reactions.
Well, just a couple of reactions is there's no question that when we reduced interest rates by 50 basis points in the United States, we're trying to bail out some people. We're trying to bail out people who have adjustable mortgages. We're trying to bail out some people who are holding those mortgages in their portfolio, hoping people will not default. So there is no question about that. And it may well lead down the road, and I think we're going to talk about this in a little while, to additional inflation. My only reaction in the foreign markets, this is not new, that European countries, Ireland, et cetera, have offered subsidies. But nevertheless, a great deal of that has been due to reduction of tax rates, for example, and again, capital is going to move where capital is treated best. No question about it.
I would agree, and I'd also like to remind the caller that I think we have to make a distinction between the short term and the long term. I'm not suggesting that there are no problems in Europe or the U.S. in the short term. There are plenty of problems. In fact, I disagree. I mean, who am I to disagree with the Fed chairman, Bernanke? But I do, and I think that the gold market, the oil market, and the foreign currency markets are more or less agreeing, you know, with me that in the short run we could have some pain, despite the fact that the stock market is at an all-time high this morning once again. But I certainly recognize there could be some short-term pain to suffer in Europe, in Ireland, UK, whatever, in the short run. But I still think that as a long-term proposition, that the fact that European countries are moving more toward the American model or the UK model, which is kind of in between the American model and the continental Europe model, the fact that they're moving toward the UK or the American model in terms of lower corporate tax rates, lower marginal rates for their citizens, lower government intervention in the economy has got to be a net plus in the long run.
At least for an investor.
That's right.
At least for an investor.
And so we have to keep our eyes on the long term. If we focus on the short term, you know, we end up selling everything. We can easily adopt a negative attitude about the short run. But that's market timing. You know, you get negative in the short run and you sell everything. Market timing fails in the long run.
All right. Thanks a lot. And our guests this morning are David Sinow, clinical professor of finance here at the U of I, and his guest, Michael Chenekel.
John Misenich.
John Misenich.
John.
I wrote Michael down
for some
reason or other. Thought. Sorry about
right.
that, John.
That's okay.
And let's go. If you have a question for either David or John this morning, give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line number one and a caller from Chicago. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I have a question for John specifically. I'm an international investor from long ago. I went into Europe back when the euro lost. I put probably half my portfolio in Europe when the euro was only worth 85 cents, so I made very well on that. I invested in South America a long time ago. Now the Brazilian currency has risen dramatically, and in Canada. I'm looking for the next place. What are your thoughts? And I agree with you on the Chinese market. I think it's going to double again, nor the Swedish market. I'm looking for the next horizon. I'm not afraid to put my money overseas. I haven't been over there for many years. What do you think of India? What do you think of some of the countries in Africa or some of the smaller republics in South America where you probably get a much bigger move when their stock market climbs?
Well, congratulations, first of all, in buying European stocks when the euro was 85 cents. That was a terrific move on your part. I didn't have the nerve at the time.
Well, actually, I think in this country we're so parochial, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
My family's from Italy. I've been over there making visits for a long time. And the Europeans are just as wealthy as us with their socialized medicine. They're even more healthier than we are. And I think we sit here and we're just so afraid to go beyond the Atlantic or the Pacific Oceans. I mean, everybody's living a life probably much better than the Americans are, especially with all their vacation time and time off and things. We're so afraid to put our dollars overseas. So that's why I'm asking your expert. And what you think of some of the more countries on the fringe.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I guess the bottom line for me is that I'm just loath to, really load up on one or two countries. I stick to traditional advice. I mean, you've got to diversify your international portfolio. So I still think that you and most people really should be in two or three well-diversified mutual funds. Maybe on the margin, you might favor India over China. This is just my personal opinion. I think that the Chinese market has gone up so much that a correction is inevitable. I used to own a fund, the China Fund. The symbol is FXI. I made about 40% in just a few months. I thought I was really smart, so I sold. And guess what? After I sold, it's up another 50%. And I just can't bring myself to buy it back after watching this fund double in about 12 months. Now, the Indian market is up also a lot, but the fact that India speaks English, it's the unofficial second language of the country, the fact that they have a very good educational system, so many of them are getting their engineering and medical degrees in this country and then going back for the first time. They used to come here and never leave, and now they're going back for the first time because there's so much economic opportunity in India. So maybe at the margin you might put a bit into India. But again, for me, I still think that that's a marginal call. Maybe 5 or 10% of your total international ought to be in those really risky markets. With the bulk of your international funds, I still think you'd be in a couple of well-diversified mutual funds.
I think the other thing that you might look at if you're trying to plug into one or two countries, take a look at the country's cash flow. That is, how many dollars are coming into the Treasury and how many dollars are going out of the Treasury. And I would be more likely to invest in those countries where they either have a positive cash flow or a very, very low negative cash flow. I really like Canada, believe it or not, even though we're now dollar for dollar. I really like Canada. I have a large number of friends involved in hedge funds and limited partnerships who are going in and buying Canadian land. This is nothing new, but I think it makes a good argument that land is still undervalued relative to the U.S., especially we've got a country that is pretty high-tech, it's very smart, and lots of land available and a positive cash flow in the Treasury. So again, that's not an emerging market. You might look at even Brazil, for example. But I would look at these countries in terms of their treasury cash flow, and I would be more likely to invest, if I was going to do this, more of my money where that has either a positive cash flow or it's delta neutral.
I have one more suggestion. The caller may consider, believe it or not, French stocks. They have a new president now, Nicolas Sarkozy. And Sarkozy sounds more American than he does French. And he's talking about relaxing some of these very stringent labor laws where a French worker can work no more than 35 hours. And he wants to institute a whole lot of pro-market reforms. The French market, I don't think, is up very much this year. And so here he is. I don't know if he's going to be successful, but I kind of think that that change is brewing among the French public. I've traveled in France a lot. I have some French friends, and that's what they tell me, that change is underway. And so you might consider dabbling in the French market.
Okay. I believe our Chicago caller has a follow-up question. Is that right?
Yeah, just one real quick, please.
Mm-hmm, sure.
With the fall of the dollar recently, do you feel that we've got a long way to go or a slow decline? Because I'm looking at gold going up. I'm looking at the euro peaking. Is this a time to buy more gold and foreign currencies? Or do you feel the big spike has already come and it will now be just a slow erosion?
Well, that's a tough question. On the euro or the yen, foreign currencies in general, I think it's going to be a slow decline of the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
But you never know. I mean, things can happen awfully quickly. But my I don't know, it's just a gut feeling. I think we're going to have a slow decline from maybe €1.41, maybe up to about $1.50. Wow. I've heard some people from Goldman Sachs and other people I respect saying that recently, that they could see the dollar going to about $1.50. So wow. if you play that with the derivatives, you know, in other words, you leverage yourself, you can make quite a bit of money on that move.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Gold, I'm afraid I missed that one too, you know. I thought about buying gold when it was at 500, 600, and here we are this morning, I think it's 742.
Right. I think the all-time high many years ago was 820.
Yeah.
All right. I'm sorry. Thanks for your call, though. We have to move on. I got a lot of phone calls. Thanks very much. Let's go on to line number two, a caller in Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with David and John.
Good morning. Thank you for this fascinating topic. Just a quick remark about gold. I missed out on gold when it was $36.
Oh, my.
That'll tell you about how old I am.
Oh, you're a youngster.
Anyway, I'm curious about something. You may not be familiar with this phenomenon in Japan. It was in one of the online national newspapers, possibly the New York Times or the Washington Post, but apparently a very quiet homegrown revolution among Japanese housewives has them doing arbitrage during their children's naps, before their kids get up, while they're in school. And right now they've taken a beating. But I was wondering if you could point me in a direction where I could learn more about that on the web. I know it's, I mean, you probably have to have a degree in it, but I was just curious.
You have me stumped.
They're thinking.
John, can you think of anything? I mean, another thing we can recommend
what kind of arbitrage, I guess? You can arbitrage any two investments, but specifically, what two investments were they arbitraging?
Oh, I see. I'm probably using the word wrong. Currency trading.
Oh,
currency. Going long in one and short in the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very dangerous. very dangerous. You can lose all of your money in one or two trading days.
Sure, but if Japanese housewives can do it, I think an American housewife can do it. And, of course, I'm not going to sink, you know, my savings into it or anything. I'm just going to investigate it.
Well, you know, here's my gut reaction. If Japanese housewives are doing it, it's probably the wrong thing to do. No offense to the Japanese housewives. But when you have ordinary, everyday people who don't know what they're doing, mm-hmm. speculating in anything, I don't care if it's real estate or bonds or currency arbitrage, it's a bad sign. It usually means that the whole game is over. That's my gut feeling.
Okay. I don't know if that helps you out, but that's the...
There went my bubble.
There you go. That happens sometimes.
Thanks a lot.
Sure, thank you. Our guests this morning are David Sinow, a regular here with a clinical professor of finance at the College of Business at the U of I, and his guest, John Misinich. And so if you have a question, give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line number three and a caller from Champaign. Good morning.
Yes, I know very little about this, but I'm an investor through mutual funds, and I've been listening to all the economists, and I think the worst thing one could do is listen to a group of economists and figure out what the real situation is, including Alan Greenspan. But my question to you is, to what degree, if you had to rate on a scale of 1 to 5, or we at risk in this country of some form of a recession within the next two quarters?
Well, I think within the next two quarters, that's going to be a little tough. I don't think we're going to see recession in the next quarter, certainly. It looks to me like Bernanke has moved pretty rapidly to head off a little bit of the subprime mortgage crisis and the housing crisis. We're still growing in this country. And if you believe the labor statistics, we still have reasonable inflation. That may change a year, 2 years down the road. But I don't see recession in the next couple of quarters. John, I don't know how you feel about that.
I would agree totally. I think it's very, very unlikely we'll have it in the next two quarters. I think if we do have it, it's probably going to be in early 2008. But let me also make a comment about the stock market, because there's a relationship between the stock market and the overall economy. If you're worried about recession, the thing to look at is not the GDP. It's actually the stock market itself, because the stock market is actually a leading indicator of what's going to happen in the economy 6 to 12 months down the road. The fact that the stock market is surging the past week or so, especially today, would indicate that good times are ahead. It's not a perfect indicator, though. But it has worked, I would say, well over half the time, that if stocks go up, we do not have a recession.
Really, and to go into a recession, you're talking about no growth or negative growth for three consecutive quarters. So it really, we're really too high in the growth pattern still. We still have a pretty positive GDP to suddenly turn negative. So I don't see that in the next couple of quarters or even the next three quarters. And I don't think Bernanke wants to leave that legacy at the moment.
I would agree. And, you know, the caller talked about, you know, paying attention to economists. I share his notion that the average economist is actually not very good at predicting the financial markets, let alone the GDP and the inflation rate and the unemployment rate. But if you had to pick one economist, here's the guy I would pick. His name is Bill Gross, G-R-O-S-S, and he's the chief bond guy at PIMCO on the West Coast. PIMCO is Pacific Investment Management Company, PIMCO. They run a group of bond mutual funds, and he's their chief bond strategist. And I have found that by listening to Bill Gross, he's quoted in the Wall Street Journal all the time. You see him on CNBC, you know, the talking heads on television. Just by listening to his forecast for interest rates and the overall economy, that he has steered me more right than wrong over the years. So look for Bill Gross.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Our numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we have someone on a cell phone. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Oh, there you are.
Yeah. My situation is, and of course I forget everybody's name, but I have a little bit something put away in euros in Finland. Could you say just a few words on how do I move them from a bank account to some kind of real investment, please? That's all I have. Thank you, Mark.
Well, I think it's just I understand that you have euros in a Finnish bank.
I think he's
I believe that's the case. I believe he's actually holding the euros.
Okay. Just instruct your bank to do a wire transfer to any other bank. Let's say your American bank. So I would call your American bank and get the wire transferring instructions. There are very specific verbiage that you need from your bank, an ABA number on the check and so forth. Get those instructions, send a fax or an email to your Finnish bank, and tell them to wire the funds to your American bank with those specific instructions. It's really that simple.
And then once they're obviously at the American bank, then one can reinvest those assets in any way that they desire. It's not very difficult. An ABA number is simply a routing number that goes through the Federal Reserve. It's usually found in the bottom left-hand corner of the check. It often starts with a zero, so you'll be able to know what that number is.
Okay. Is our caller still there?
Yes, sir.
Oh, you are still there.
I've done that before, but my question I was not clear. I wanted to just invest it over there because I still have family over there and I go there frequently and I like to have it over there. How do I go about finding investment over in Finland?
Well, that's a good question. I think the first thing to do is talk to the investment people at the Finnish bank. And ask them, you know, what do they have available? If you're willing to take the risk in stocks, maybe an all-European fund. Again, I don't think I would load up just on the stocks of one country like Finland. Fine place. But I would look maybe, again, if you're willing to take the risk for an all-European stock fund that doesn't have much of a commission up front, hopefully no commission up front, and has low annual expenses. And look at the track record of the fund. Look at the 5- and 10-year record.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Our numbers are 333-9455, or if you're outside the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. And let's go to line number one and a caller from Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air with David and John.
Are you hearing me?
Yes, sure are.
Yes, good morning.
Oh, okay. I thought I was... number two, excuse me. I have a lighthearted question and a more serious one. The lighthearted one is, why is Davidson a clinical professor?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I wear a white coat every day. Every day. Well, I can tell you, and that is often asked, and it's always smile when I hear clinical professor.
Okay.
A clinical professor, typically at the University of Illinois, is an individual who holds a Ph.D., often has spent a substantial period of time in private industry like myself, in fact, more than 29 years in private industry and entrepreneurial efforts, but did not go the standard tenure route track as a usual professor who goes through, gets a PhD, then is hired as an assistant professor, publishes profusely, and eventually then reaches nirvana, which is the associate professor level with tenure. Very frankly, I wasn't too concerned about that at my stage of the career. So as a result, when I joined the university, they had to give me some title. So they called me a clinical professor. I asked, do I wear a white coat? Do I wear a white tie? I'm not sure. But that's the bottom line of why I'm called a clinical professor of finance.
Okay, okay. And now, thank you.
Oh,
my
pleasure.
I've always wondered. Okay, and now the more serious question. I'm holding some funds in a REIT.
In a REIT.
REIT. Okay.
Yes.
Not a very large, maybe 2% of my
portfolio?
Yes, perhaps.
Okay.
Yes. Should I sell it now?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't think so. First of all, if you're in a REIT, I presume you're in a REIT mutual fund.
Correct.
All right. And does this mutual fund contain many, many companies that are essentially REITs themselves? So you must be in some type of REIT index.
No, I have no idea. It's American Century Real Estate Stock Fund.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's a fund that holds literally scores of other stocks and companies. And all of these companies have something in common, and that is that they buy, sell, and manage real estate. That's what a REIT really is. So you have a REIT mutual fund, which essentially holds lots and lots of these real estate companies. Most of those are going to be commercial real estate companies. They're going to hold warehouses and hotels. They're going to hold shopping centers, apartment buildings, etc. And if you look at the long-term track record of REITs, it's been outstanding, and it's a wonderful diversifier in a portfolio. Now, you only have 2%. So 2% is not certainly overweighted by any stretch of the imagination as part of your overall portfolio. In my portfolio, for example, I have 5% REITs. Now, not every asset class is going to go up each year. And for example, this year, your REIT portfolio is probably down 4 or 5% for the year. But let's think about that. 2% of 5% is about 0.1%. So the impact on your overall portfolio is about maybe a negative 0.1%. And more importantly, it does represent a diversifier. You don't want all of the things that you're investing in going in the same direction all of the time. Because that would mean, well, when things go down, they all go down. And historically, certainly over the last 5 and 10 years, REITs have outperformed almost every other asset class. So don't give up on it. You're in a great family of mutual funds, and hang on to your REIT position.
Oh, okay, even though real estate has all the questions.
Well, the real estate that you're hearing about are typically people who shouldn't have gotten mortgages in the first place. Those are subprime mortgages.
Right.
The real estate investment companies are in the business of owning commercial and multifamily real estate. They're landlords. They're leasing properties out. It's a different animal for the most part.
So should I buy a little more?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm going to let John hit that. But, you know, I'm at 5%. You're at 2%.
Yeah.
So if I was a consistent money manager, I would say I would feel real bad if you moved up and dollar cost averaged up to a 5% position. But I hate the idea of your selling that 2%. I'm really down on your doing that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I would agree with that, too. I think the caller ought to even consider buying more since they're down. And I think the fact that the REIT is down and the stock market in general is up is actually, you can spin that positively. Because, again, it shows that the correlation is very low to moderate, and, in fact, in this case, negative. That's exactly what you want in your portfolio, that when times get bad, you know, you're opposite to what is doing well and vice versa. So if the REIT were to go down more, I would consider buying more and bring yourself up from 2% to 5%.
All right. And let's go on to line number two. And we have a caller from Urbana. You're on the air with David and John this morning. Hi, line number two.
For all the dollar bears out there, but something interesting happened recently. I was reading the UK Telegraph, the newspaper, and in it they mentioned Saudi Arabia, that usually mimics all the FOMC moves, had refused to cut interest rates in lockstep with the U.S. Federal Reserve for the first time. And in the article, it was signaling that the oil-rich Gulf Kingdom is, you know, maybe preparing to break the dollar currency peg, which could potentially cause a cascading chain reaction across the Middle East. And then, you know, we had Chinese government had kind of a concerted campaign of economic threats against the United States, hinting that it might liquidate, you know, vast holdings of U.S. treasuries. And, you know, it just seems as all these stories are just so pervasive and seem to be everywhere. It just seems that, you know, everybody's so down on the dollar. I'm just feeling that maybe it may not be long from now. It'd be a good time to buy. But I'd like you to comment first on the Saudi Arabian situation and then the Chinese, and I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, I have to admit, I don't have a clue about the Saudi Arabian thing. I read that same article, and I'm still kind of puzzled about the implications of that. But in terms of China liquidating, you know, you read this all the time. This comes up probably once a week, some story in the Wall Street Journal that watch out if the Chinese sell all their treasury bonds. That'll really cause interest rates to jump. But, you know, I don't think it's going to happen, because where are the Chinese going to go with their money? They have such a huge trade surplus. The money is building up so fast. There's nothing else practically that they can buy. I know they can diversify into the euro, and they have, and into the yen. But there are only so many euros and yen that you can buy. And the Japanese and the Europeans are really discouraging the Chinese from doing that, because it makes their currencies more valuable. It hurts their export market. And so I do think that the Chinese will probably continue to diversify away from the dollar, our treasury bonds, a little bit, and that will cause the dollar to have a mild decline, say, you know, $1.40 euro to $1.50. But I just don't see the Chinese dumping all of their treasury bonds en masse, because they just don't have another place to go with their money.
I agree with you, John, and let's think about this. Let's look at the total national debt. If we look at the national debt clock, we're now a little bit over $9 trillion. The last time I looked at what was held in treasuries by China was somewhere, John, I think about $350 billion.
Right.
All right? Which is a little bit more than 3% of our overall national debt. So let's put this back in perspective. And let's just, for example, say that they sold 20% of their treasuries off, $75 billion. That's really a drop in the bucket when you consider the overall national debt, and there are still plenty of people who are looking at the Treasury as a safe harbor. And why is it such a safe harbor? Because regardless of whether we agree politically with our leaders or disagree, we are still the most politically stable regime in the world. And when everything gets said and done, as long as we have that political stability, there will always be times when there is going to be a flight to quality, a flight to U.S. Treasury. So I'm not terribly concerned about that.
All right. We have about 7 or 8 minutes left here on Focus 580. Our guests this morning are John Macinich and our favorite market
clinical
guy,
professor.
Our favorite professor, David Sinow, this morning. Let's go to line number 3 and a caller on a cell phone. Good morning. You're on the air with John and David this morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wondered if John and David had any knowledge or opinion of Australia as a possible place to invest in either companies or banks, or just if you know anything about how Australians doing, Australian. The dollar is doing and how it might do in the future, and I'm going to hang up and listen on the air.
Yeah, I'm kind of bullish on Australia. I know the currency is rising. I remember a few years ago the currency was only about 55 or 60 cents compared to the American dollar, and now I think it's about 85 cents.
86, just about 86.
And, you know, verging toward parity with the American dollar. So if you had been in Australian stocks or bonds or real estate, that would have been very good because the currency is going up. Will that continue? I don't know. Probably. They're doing very well in Australia right now. They've also instituted a lot of pro-market reforms. But, again, the bottom line for me, sounding like a broken record, I just wouldn't load up in any one country. I think Australian stocks within the confines of a well-diversified international fund is the way to go.
John, I second your remarks. I think Australia is a great place to invest, but you have to do it within a larger umbrella of investments. But Australia is a great country. There's a number of people. There are a lot of issues about owning land in Australia, but there are ways to own land in Australia. I think that's still a good bet especially with the currency continuing to escalate against the American dollar. So I like land in Australia.
There is one risk factor in Australia. Global warming is really impacting them much more than other places. 90% of the country is a virtual desert, and there's a huge water problem, and that water problem has just been exacerbated by global warming. So how they solve that, I don't know, maybe desalination. So, there's always a risk factor with any of these countries, including our own.
All right. We have a few minutes left here on Focus 580 this morning. If you have a finance question, you can give us a call at 333-9455 or outside of the 217 area code 800-222-9455. And let's go to line number one and a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a large stack of double E bonds, U.S. savings bonds, and they're in my husband's name, who is deceased, and mine, and I'd like to have them transferred over so my son will get them, because I'm in my mid-80s. Now, what should I do with these?
Well, I think the easiest thing to do, first of all, is go down to a local financial institution where you bank, because they can tell you specifically, one, what the imputed interest is on those bonds. All right? Now, you probably held those bonds in joint tenancy with your husband.
Yes.
Was it in your Social Security number or your husband's Social Security number?
Yes.
His Social Security number. So it sounds to me that you want to add a son to this along with yourself.
Certainly.
Now, if you do that and you use your Social Security number, then you really haven't at that point in time made a completed gift. If you use his Social Security number, then you actually have made a completed gift of those bonds, even though you're holding them jointly. So you probably, depending upon the size of your estate, there might be a legal question that you want to consult with your attorney about, as well as the appropriate way and whose Social Security number should be utilized. It's not that difficult, however, simply to add another child's name onto an account. The real issue is what Social Security number you're now going to use.
Okay. Now, I know some of them have matured or whatever you call that.
Yes.
Some of them aren't old enough.
Okay. Well, some of them might have matured where you are no longer earning interest.
That's right.
And that is not a good idea. And people sometimes do this because they just hate to pay the income tax on cashing them in. But to be honest about it, you're better off cashing them in and redeploying that asset and paying that income tax.
Yes.
All right? So that's why I'm recommending that you go down to your financial institution. They actually can call it up online for you on computer, or they may indeed even have hard copy there, and they can tell you precisely which ones have matured and what your options are.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. We have about 2 minutes left in the show. If you have a quick question for David or John, you're on the air from Champaign. Line number two, I should say. Line number two? Hey, there you are.
Hi, I'll make this quick. I'm doing an assignment for class. I need to diversify a portfolio that has 50% equity in Del Monte Foods. It's a food industry, so I can't really think of anything that'd be negatively correlated with food. I hope you don't take offense to asking for kind of quote-unquote homework help.
This sounds like a Finance 300 issue.
Yeah.
That you're supposed to find a diversifier for Del Monte Foods. And you know that Professor Olfaten and Professor Waspy, who head up Fin 300, are amazing faculty. In fact, Professor Waspy occasionally appears on this program, and I don't think I really should tell you the answer to that question because they would get angry at me, and I don't think either Professor Masetich or myself want to incur the wrath of Waspy and Olfaten. Unless, John, you want to make a comment to that?
I actually don't mind incurring their wrath.
Okay.
You're out of here shortly.
That's right. You know, why don't you consider a gold mining stock? Go to your Excel spreadsheet, plug in some rates of return for a gold mining stock. I have a suspicion it might be negatively correlated with the food stock off the top of my head.
I'll take a look at metals.
Yeah.
Good.
All right.
That's a wise choice.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Should we try one more call,
one more call.
Real quick from Hoopston, line number three. You're on the air.
Yes, question. Capital gains tax. Do you think if the Democrats would take over the presidency, they'd be tempted to raise capital gains tax?
I definitely think so.
I concur.
It's a great source of revenue, although there's a big debate about whether the Treasury will actually realize that revenue. There's a lot of evidence that as capital gains rates go up, revenues to the Treasury actually go down.
Right, and historically, you're absolutely right, John, that every time we've had a reduction of capital gains taxes, huge amounts of dollars have poured into the U.S. Treasury. Nevertheless, it's a viable target if the political mainstream changed.
I agree. So I would probably bet on it if in fact, a Democrat is elected. And that's I'm not making any political statement one way or the other on that.
All right. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. All right. That's going to do it for the show today. John Macinich has been with us this morning, and our favorite clinical professor of finance, David Sinow. David, thank you very much.
Well, you know, we've had a lot of fun this morning.
It has been a lot of fun this
morning. We've talked about a lot of topics that we generally don't, and John, you seem to have a lot of expertise in those. You've helped me out a great deal this morning, so thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure. I find it really interesting that somebody from Belgium called us this morning. That was great.
I think that's Belgium, Illinois, but that's okay.
Sorry.
Anyway, thanks a lot.